Vicatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vicatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are taking, well, a fascinating and pretty profound shortcut into the intellectual powerhouse that is Indian philosophical thought.
Mm-hmm.
We're using Sue Hamilton's excellent work, Indian Philosophy, as our guide. It's quite a journey navigating something like 3,000 years of rigorous debate.
It really is. And it's necessary work, I think, because, you know, in the West, we often have this tendency to dismiss this whole tradition as just spiritual or maybe religious.
Right, mystical, maybe.
Exactly. But Hamilton, she fundamentally challenges that. She shows that these are actually sophisticated systems of rational, quite technical inquiry, and they were developed not just for, you know, academic argument, but to address what they saw as the most urgent human problem.
Which is the core relevance, isn't it? These thinkers weren't primarily asking, what's the universe made of? Though they did touch on that.
Sure, that came into it.
But the real question was, how do we achieve liberation from suffering? I mean, it's fundamentally practical knowledge. It's aimed at transformation.
That's the mission for you, our listener, today.
Right.
We want to try and pull out the unified intellectual framework that kind of ties together this massive, diverse tradition. We want to show how schools that might seem completely unrelated on the surface, like, say, Vedanta and Buddhism, are actually locked in this highly rational, millennium-spanning debate.
A debate over the same fundamental diagnosis and the same ultimate goal of a cure, right?
Precisely. They agree on the problem, generally, but differ hugely on the solution.
Okay, so let's begin with our guide then. Who is Sue Hamilton, and why is her perspective so useful here?
Well, Professor Sue Hamilton is a really distinguished scholar of Indian philosophy and religions. She spent over 3 decades in the field, mostly at King's College London. And crucially, she has the linguistic authority. Her PhD is in Sanskrit and Indian studies, so she can engage directly with the original texts, the Pali and Sanskrit sources.
Which is vital, but I think the key for us, you know, the general reader, is that she acts as a bridge. She takes that really specialist knowledge and makes it accessible, but she also uses this unique methodology, which really makes the subject, well, leap off the page, I found.
Yeah, absolutely. That methodology is what's called the phenomenological approach. So instead of just listing doctrines, you know, school X believes this, school Y believes that Hamilton tries to understand why they exist. She asks, essentially, what kind of subjective experience, what perception of reality could have led these incredible thinkers, you know, from the Upanishadic sages to the Buddha, to arrive at their foundational conclusions?
So it frames the whole tradition as more of an analysis of consciousness, of the human condition itself, rather than just abstract theory. It's an internal investigation.
Exactly. She prioritizes the experiential basis, the kind of fundamental existential suffering they were all trying to solve. And that anchors the entire tradition in this profound practical relevance. It's not just dusty old ideas.
Okay, let's look at the central argument of the book then, because you said this is the key to unlocking everything else. Hamilton argues Indian philosophy is fundamentally soteriological.
Mm-hmm. Soteriological, it's a great word. It just means it's driven by that practical goal of achieving liberation, whether you call it moksha in the Hindu traditions or nirvaya in Buddhism, freedom from suffering.
And for that goal to even make sense, you first need to establish the problem, right? The universal issue they're trying to fix.
Exactly. The book shows that pretty much all the schools, despite their differences, share this cluster of foundational concepts. It forms what you might call the basic Indian worldview.
Okay, so first the problem itself, samsara. Now, it's often translated just as reincarnation, but Hamilton stresses it's more than that. It's the whole cyclical nature of existence.
Right. This continuous, often frustrating repetition, dissatisfaction, death, rebirth. It's like being stuck on a wheel, a loop we're trying to get out of.
And the mechanism, the engine driving that loop, is karma.
Yeah, and karma is crucial to understand correctly. It's not fate, not destiny handed down from somewhere. It's presented as an impersonal natural law, moral cause and effect. Every action, every intention, even your thoughts, they create ripples, future consequences. And these determine where and how you reappear in that cycle of samsara.
Wow. Okay. And sort of holding it all together is dharma.
Dharma is a big one. It's complex, but you can think of it as the cosmic and moral order, the right way of living, the structure of reality, your duty within it. It's the framework.
So the problem is samsara. The mechanism is karma. The framework is dharma. And the goal, then, is the cessation of the cycle, moksha or nirvana.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Liberation. So the entire philosophical tradition, Hamilton argues, is essentially this centuries-long, highly rational debate. All the schools pretty much agree on samsara and karma existing. Where they fight, often quite bitterly, is over the diagnosis, what causes the suffering within samsara, and therefore what's the right cure to escape it.
Okay, that makes sense. So to trace that argument, we have to start near the beginning, right? With that foundational shift from external ritual to internal insight.
Yeah, the earliest Vedic traditions, they focus very heavily on external rituals, the ajanya, the sacrifices. These were performed mainly to maintain cosmic order, called aitha. It was about keeping the universe in balance through action.
But then in the Upanishads, there's this pivot, yeah. A major shift inward.
Huge shift. Thinkers started asking different questions. They moved beyond appeasing external gods and started asking, what is the ultimate reality behind or underneath the universe? What is Brahman? And crucially, what is the true nature of the individual self? What is Atman?
And the answer they came up with was, well, absolutely revolutionary for its time. Atnom Brahman.
Boom. Yeah. The ultimate reality underlying the entire cosmos, Brahman, is identical to the deepest essence of your individual self, Atna. They aren't separate.
So the path to mokha, to liberation, is simply realizing this non-separation, experientially knowing it.
It's liberation through knowledge, radical knowledge. The suffering, they argued, comes from the illusion of being separate. Once you truly realize deep down that thou art tatvam asi, the bonds of samsara just dissolve.
That sounds incredibly profound and optimistic in a way, but also deeply challenging.
Definitely challenging. It's not easy knowledge to attain.
But hang on, if that's the complete solution, realizing the permanent eternal self frees you, then why did the Buddha come along later and, well, reject it entirely? That seems like a massive break.
It is the central fault line. It's the crux of the whole tradition, and that's what makes it so intellectually dynamic and fascinating. The Buddha, see, he accepted the basic framework. Samsara is real, karma operates.
Yeah.
But he radically rejected the core Upanishadic idea of a permanent, unchanging Atman.
Ah, okay. This is his core philosophical innovation, then, the doctrine of no self and Atman.
Exactly, an Atman, no Atman.
So instead of being this eternal soul or entity, the self in Buddhist philosophy is just a collection of things.
Pretty much. It's described as merely a composite, a bundle of five ever-changing aggregates, the skandhas. These are things like your physical form, your feelings, perceptions, mental habits or formations, and consciousness itself. Always shifting, always impermanent.
So there's no permanent me underneath all that.
According to the Buddha, no. And he argued that clinging to the belief in a permanent self, when in reality none exists, is the very root cause of our suffering, our dukkha. We grasp at something that isn't there.
And liberation, nirvana, is achieved. How?
Not by finding some true self, but by extinguishing the craving, the clinging, the thirst that arises from this fundamental illusion of self. It's an intellectual argument, yes, but with massive therapeutic implications. Seeing things clearly frees you.
Wow. Okay, so that dynamic debate, the identity of a permanent self versus the illusion of any permanent self, that's what really fuels the development of the later schools, like the six classical Hindu orthodox systems, the darshanas.
Precisely. They are, in many ways, responses and refinements, building on these foundations and reacting to the Buddhist challenge.
And darshana is a key term you mentioned.
Yes, Hamilton really emphasizes this. It literally means a seeing or a point of view. So these aren't just random philosophies. They are systematic philosophical perspectives. Each one offers a path to liberation based on its specific seeing, its specific understanding of reality.
Okay, let's quickly look at them in their traditional pairs. First, we have Sakya Yoga.
Right. Sakya provides the metaphysical map, you could say. It's fundamentally dualistic. It posits this absolute distinction between pure consciousness, puru, the witness, the self, and all of material nature, including mind purdas.
And suffering comes from?
Suffering arises from confusing the two, mistaking the ever-changing phenomena of prakriti, thoughts, feelings, body, for the pure, unchanging consciousness of puru. We identify with the wrong thing.
And yoga, that provides the how-to.
Exactly. Yoga, especially as codified by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, adopts the Sakya diagnosis and provides the practical, methodical path. It's the eight-limbed process Atoga Yoga, the meditative discipline designed to achieve discrimination, viveka, which leads to kaivalya, the isolation or realization of puru as fundamentally separate from prati.
Got it. Then the next pair, Nyaya Vaishinka. These sound a bit more academic.
They can seem that way. They focus heavily on logic, and a kind of atomic metaphysics, Vaisheka. Their path to liberation is essentially through rigorous rational analysis. They're deeply concerned with epistemology, how we know what we know, establishing the valid means of knowledge, the pramanas. For them, true understanding, achieved through logic and discerning the categories of reality, eliminates the ignorance that binds us to Saisara.
Liberation through logic, almost.
In a nutshell, yes.
Yeah.
Clear thinking leads to freedom.
And the final pair.
So Mimamsa originally focused primarily on the correct interpretation and performance of Vedic ritual, seeing that as the path. But Vedanta is where things get really philosophically rich, building directly on the Upanishads. This is where that core Atman Brahman identity is fully explored and developed into sophisticated systems. The most famous is probably Advaita Vedanta non-dualism, championed by thinkers like Sokara. It argues ultimate reality is singular, non-dual consciousness.
Right. What strikes me across all these schools, reading Hamilton's account, is the sheer intellectual rigor. It's not just vague mysticism.
Not at all. Hamilton really drives this home. Indian philosophers developed complex systems of formal logic, rules of inference, detailed analyses of perception, language, consciousness. These were every bit as sophisticated as anything happening in ancient Greece or later in Europe, and often anticipated concerns that Western philosophy only got to much later.
It completely dismantles that fluffy mystic stereotype, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And it underscores again that fundamental unity of theory and practice we mentioned. For any of these schools, true knowledge isn't just an intellectual exercise. It must lead to transformation. Meditation, ethical conduct, dharma, self-discipline, these aren't optional religious extras. They are integral parts of the philosophical path itself. Knowing requires doing and being.
Okay, so if we step back now and look at the whole picture through Hamilton's lens, what are maybe the three or four most essential big picture themes she leaves us with?
Well, the first, which we've touched on a lot, is that core message. Philosophy is soteriology. The whole purpose of this vast intellectual enterprise is functional. Knowledge is for liberation. It's meant to change your life. There's almost an ethical obligation. If you learn these concepts, you should strive to live them. It really pushes back against any notion of philosophy as just, you know, academic games.
Yeah, knowledge for transformation. What's next?
The second major theme is the sophisticated analysis of consciousness. I mean, the detailed investigations of mental states, particularly in the Buddhist Abhidhamma and the yogic traditions, they're astounding. They relied heavily on meditative introspection, on first-person examination of the mind. And the taxonomies, the maps of mental states and processes they developed are incredibly detailed.
It makes you think, doesn't it? We rely so much on third-person observation, brain scans, and so on in cognitive science today. But these traditions were doing systematic empirical analysis of mind from the inside 2,000 years ago.
Their classifications of mental formations, perceptions, states of concentration, they're profoundly deep and, frankly, still very relevant.
Okay, theme three must be the big one, the central drama.
Absolutely. The centrality of the self-debate, that profound schism we discussed between realizing a permanent ultimate self, Atman and Vedanta, and dissolving the illusion of any permanent self on Atman in Buddhism. That really is the driving narrative of much of Indian philosophy.
And it's still so relevant, isn't it? Our modern struggles with identity, ego, existential anxiety.
Incredibly relevant. Whether you ultimately lean towards the Vedantic view or the Buddhist one, the frameworks they provide for understanding the very structure of your own identity and how that structure relates to suffering and well-being are just unmatched, I think.
And a final theme, maybe something about the method.
Yeah, I'd say the fourth is reinforcing the point about rational argumentation and logical rigor. Hamilton constantly challenges that old stereotype by emphasizing the development of formal logic, strict rules of inference, and centuries of detailed point-by-point debate between the schools. This tradition was as argumentative and rationally grounded as any other.
Right. These complex ideas, as Hamilton shows, were often distilled into these powerful, really condensed phrases or sutras. Maybe we could look at three quick quotes that sort of encapsulate the main movements.
Good idea. The first has to be that defining line of Advaita Vedanta, which you mentioned earlier, Tat Vam Asi.
That thou art. What does it really point to?
It's that radical claim of non-separation. Your deepest individual essence, your consciousness, is fundamentally identical with the ultimate reality, the ground of all being. There's no gap. It implies this total inherent connection, maybe even inherent worth. It's liberation through realizing that identity.
Powerful. Okay, second quote. Maybe from the other side of the debate.
Let's take the foundational Buddhist insight, the first noble truth, often put simply as, All conditioned existence is suffering.
Which can sound pretty bleak, right? Pessimistic.
It can, but Hamilton, like most scholars, explains this isn't meant as pessimism. It's more like a doctor's diagnosis. It's an empirical observation about the pervasive nature of dissatisfaction, dukkha, in any state bound by conditions, by impermanence. Accepting this diagnosis isn't wallowing. It's the necessary first step. It's what motivates you to look for the cause and the cure, which the other noble truths provide.
Okay, a diagnostic tool. And a third one, maybe linking philosophy to practice.
How about Patanjali's famous definition from the Yoga Sutras? Yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. Yoga Sita Viti Nirotha.
Ah, right. That cuts through the modern idea of yoga as just physical exercise, doesn't it?
Completely. It reveals the philosophical core, the ultimate aim of all the practices, the postures, asana, the breathwork, pranayama, the concentration exercises, is this mental discipline. Hita Viti Nirotha, stilling the whirlpools, the modifications of the mind stuff, that stillness leads to profound clarity, undistracted awareness, and ultimately the discrimination Sakya Yoga aims for.
So taking all this incredible transformative knowledge, how do we actually make it applicable today? What are the real life tools we can maybe gain from this deep dive?
Well, application one flows directly from that discussion of mind, mindfulness and non-identification. The philosophical analysis behind a not man, no self in Buddhism, or even the Sakya discrimination between Pudo and Prakti gives us a practical method. We learn to observe our thoughts and emotions without automatically identifying with them.
Ah, so recognizing I am having a thought of anger, rather than just I am angry.
Exactly. You start to see that you are the awareness in which the thought or emotion appears, not the thought or emotion itself. And that space, that non-identification, radically reduces emotional reactivity, stress, and suffering. It's a philosophical basis for a lot of modern therapeutic mindfulness.
Makes sense. Okay, application two.
Let's focus on radical personal responsibility through a proper understanding of karma. We really need to stop seeing it as some kind of mystical fate or predestiny.
And instead?
Embrace it as Hamilton presents it. An impersonal, natural law of cause and effect, like gravity, but operating on the moral and intentional level. And seeing it that way is actually incredibly empowering.
How so?
Because it forces conscious decision-making. You realize that your present choices, mental, verbal, physical, are literally the creative force shaping your future experiences, potentially even your future lives within Saisara. Ethics isn't just nice. It becomes a kind of pragmatic survival mechanism. Your actions have consequences. You are responsible.
That's a powerful reframing. Okay, one more application.
Let's take finding purpose through Dharma. Now, Dharma is complex, but we can translate it into a modern context. Think of it as finding your unique integrity, your authentic role, your responsibility within the larger community and the world.
So it's like an ethical compass.
Yes, or a framework for meaningful engagement. It encourages moving beyond purely short-term, self-serving interests and asking, what is my contribution? What is my duty, in the best sense of the word? How can I live in alignment with a larger order? That search itself can lead to a much more meaningful life.
You know, thinking back on our discussion, what stood out most to me was that concept of darshana, a point of view, a seeing. It's not just about what you believe intellectually, it's about how that belief shapes how you actually see reality. And crucially, that seeing must be integrated with your practice, with how you live. It's a constant challenge, I think, to make knowledge truly transformative, not just, you know, another piece of interesting trivia.
That's a great takeaway. For me, I think the key unifying insight Hamilton provides is that unparalleled clarity she brings to the debate itself. Seeing all these incredibly diverse, highly sophisticated systems, you know, from the profound non-dualism of Shakara to the radical empiricism of the Buddha, not as isolated curiosities, but as coherent, competing, yet equally rigorous responses to that single shared problem of human suffering within Saisara.
Right. They're all trying to solve the same puzzle.
Exactly. And that shared focus, that common ground, even in their disagreements, is what gives the entire tradition its incredible intellectual power and its enduring relevance. It makes the whole landscape make sense.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhatra Foundation.